which is about the flow of legal knowledge. We have three speakers, Hugh Tomlinson, David Goldberg, and I'm going to talk for about 10 minutes or so, or a bit longer, and then we'll have some time for discussion and questions. So, over to you, Hugh.
Thank you very much, I begin with a disclaimer. I can't claim any credit at all for organising this event, but it is a very important, very wide-ranging topic. I mean, some of the high issues of principle that Geoffrey Robertson mentioned earlier are of the greatest importance to everybody, and then they range to a series of practical issues about access to justice and access to legal information and knowledge. I'm going to talk about quite a narrow topic this morning, which is the accessibility of legal knowledge and information. The principle of accessibility is, of course, crucial to the rule of law. Those of you, I imagine everybody in this room has read Tom Bingham's wonderful book on the rule of law. His first principle that he says is a principle of the rule of law is the law must be accessible. That means the law must be public and ascertainable. In other words, there must be simple and straightforward ways of finding out what it is. Now, the reality is that for most of our legal history, the law has in practice not been accessible to the public at all. In contrast to civil law jurisdictions in recent centuries where they've had codes of law, in England we find the law essentially in two places, in statutes which are produced in unbelievably huge numbers and are traditionally very difficult to get hold of, and in case law. Statutes I won't say very much about. There's a very interesting House of Commons library study of statute law from 2 or 3 years ago, pointing out that there are something like now 50 to 100 Acts of Parliament a year and 2,000 statutory instruments, between them running to something like 15,000 pages of new statutory material a year. The idea that that's in any way sensibly accessible by the public is ridiculous. For many centuries, the only way that that was in any way accessible was through those with access to specialist legal libraries. In terms of case law, I mean the history of how English case law was reported and commented on is a fascinating one. Unfortunately, I don't have time to talk about it, but it was a matter of private enterprise. I mean, moonlighting barristers would, with varying degrees of competence, note down what the judges had said and then publish them in books, sometimes many years after the event, sometimes wholly inaccurately. The system was, for hundreds of years, completely haphazard. It was ordered in the 1860s when a group of lawyers got together and set up the Council of Law Reporting, which ordered and regulated the system and was incorporated in the turn of the century and made it slightly more accessible, made law reports slightly easier to get hold of, although there were financial barriers. I mean, law reports have always been expensive. It was estimated in the 1860s that to buy annually the law reports would cost £45, which in today's money is about £4,000. The law reports were highly selective and always have been, and there was a barrier to access to the law by just what was reported. It's a remarkable fact that until the 1950s, judgments of the Court of Appeal were not recorded. There were no transcripts made. So unless a law reporter wasn't in court, that was the end of it, that the judgment was just not known about. Perhaps even more remarkable fact is that although the Court of Appeal and the High Court started to be recorded in the 1950s, the House of Lords was never recorded, so it was impossible to know what had been said in a House of Lords hearing. Right until its abolition, there were no formal transcripts ever made. Now, the position when I started out in practice, that's 30 years ago, was essentially not much different from the position it had been 150 years earlier. There was, if you had access to specialist law libraries, you could find out about the law. Basically, there was the priestly caste of lawyers between the public and legal knowledge. Law was not accessible in any sensible, straightforward way. The position has improved, of course, fairly substantially, and we are moving towards transparency with the way that the internet makes statute and case law available. As you may know, the government have gone through a series of semi-competent, badly organised attempts to get statute law databases set up. It's improving. I noted yesterday when I just had a look at this that they've now revised statutes up to 2002. So if you look at the statute online, it's only 10 years out of date, which is not stupendously helpful. But they do say it is going to be improved. You can get statutory instruments. I mean, the position has transformed out of all recognition in terms of practical accessibility to statute law in the last 20 years. In terms of case law, well, we have the wonderful free services pioneered, I think, by the Australian OSLI and then the Bailey service in England. I just want to mention, I'm conscious that time is short, I just want to mention, although we're moving in the right direction, just a number of concerns that I have. The first is, although some judgments are available online, it's a very small percentage of those given. There's almost nothing from the criminal courts. There are transcribing companies who have exclusive contractual rights to produce transcripts, and you have to pay for them. So if a judgment is transcribed, the only way you can get it is by paying the company. The law is not accessible to the general public. It's only accessible to those who can afford whatever the fee is. That is a position which should not be acceptable in a democratic society. The second concern I have is this, that the English law has a long tradition of orality. Something that Lord Duboger commented adversely on not too long ago in a speech. We spend inordinate lengths of time, even now, reading documents, talking things through, which makes the law a lot more expensive than it ought to be. But the system has improved. I mean, again, in the past 30 years, there's now a lot of written legal submissions. In civil cases, witness statements are written documents which stand as evidence in chief. Public access to those documents is extremely limited. In theory, journalists and the public can obtain them. In practice, it's very difficult. It depends, in effect, on the goodwill of the parties, because a journalist, Mike Dodd, unrivaled experience in this area, will tell you, a journalist turns up in court and asks for them. If the parties are well prepared and they can hand them to the journalist, often they don't have them. And then an application has to be made for access to the court file. That seems to me a wholly unacceptable position. There's absolutely no reason why these documents, when lodged in court, couldn't be lodged electronically and put on a publicly available website. In the superior courts in many jurisdictions, the United States, South Africa, Canada, you can get the written arguments on the web. Go to the Supreme Court of Canada website. There you have the factum is available for each case. Same with the US Supreme Court. That's something which ought to be done in England. And as cases become increasingly written in form, without access to those documents, things become increasingly obscure. The position is that the way that the courts operate is still shrouded in mystery. No, again, it's a very simple matter. In many countries, judicial bulletins are issued telling you what cases are coming up, what order cases are going to be heard. In England, it's very difficult to find out. I mean, the law is not simply accessible in that way. Geoffrey mentioned a very important point. I mean, it's always seemed to me that not, rather like not televising Parliament, not televising the courts, it is simply a question of prejudice, in the sense that in the old days, the only way you could find out what was going on at an event was to go there and take a note, a journalist publishing. Nowadays, we have a very simple way. You can have it on television. Why don't we have it on television? Well, for many years it was argued that Parliament shouldn't be televised because it would somehow damage democracy. Now that argument seems ludicrous. Why shouldn't the higher courts be televised? There's no actually rational reason against it. It's certainly in relation to the higher courts. Now the one very small area where we are ahead of at least the United States is we're televising the Supreme Court. Although, of course, other jurisdictions have been doing it for years. But at least that's some small progress. But why are we not doing it in all higher courts, and possibly in all courts with protections for witnesses in some cases? Well, it's something that seems to me ought to come as soon as possible. And the message I want to give just under this topic of accessibility to justice is that the technical means are now there to produce a level of accessibility which is appropriate. Historically, we've never had, and it can really be done very simply indeed. And the message that this conference and people here ought to be sending out to the authorities and to politicians and via the press is that these steps should be taken, that the basic documents, the basic material which the law depends, should become publicly accessible, and that will be to the benefit of everyone.
Our next speaker is David Goldberg.
Thanks. Thank you very much, Chair, and good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm going to be taking a very brief sort of comparative slash historical approach to this issue, as I've been invited to do by Judith. And for those of you that are, is there any jurisprudence freaks or geeks in the room? No, I didn't think so. Having taught the thing for 30 years, it was very difficult to find anyone who didn't either fear or loathe the subject. It's just that my title, Justice in a Cold Climate, is an allusion to a great article written by H.L.A. Hart on the Scandinavian legal realists. And I'll be coming back to Scandinavia in just a little moment. I was very pleased that Geoffrey Robertson, in a conference on justice in the digital era or access, started with the 13th century. So I feel that gives me a little more license than I might otherwise have had to mention a couple of interesting statutes of the old Scottish Parliament. I mean the real Scottish Parliament, not the wee pretendy thing we've got now. It's the one we're going to get back after October 2014. And there were, in fact, two statutes, one of which is still valid and in force, but the first one, which isn't, which was called the Evidence Act 1686, laid down that there shall be publication of the testimonies of witnesses. Now, that is not per se a valid enforced statute at the moment. It's been subsequently replaced, but that's, I think, a not uninteresting piece of historical news. And the second, which still is in force, which is the Court of Session Act 1693, and it's still in force, I think gives us a lovely phrase, which I think was sort of touched on by Geoffrey, because the second statute provides, you know, I don't have to do a sort of bad pretend ersatz Billy Connolly accent when I read out the terms of this statute, because I've already got that by my own inherent being, because the statute says, in all time coming, all bills, reports, debates, probations, and others relating to processes shall be considered, reasoned, advised, and voted by the Lords of Session, and here comes the crucial phrase, with open doors, with open doors. That's actually in a 1693 statute of the Act of the old Scottish Parliament. And I think that phrase, with open doors, is a nice one, and it may give a sort of Scottish sort of root to the notion of open justice. By the way, we don't bother with Scott and Scott and R versus the Sussex justices, because we've got an older case from 1897, I do beg your pardon, 1879, called Richardson versus Wilson, which talks about the publication by newspapers of what takes place in a court at the hearing of a case is undoubtedly lawful. That was Lord President Ingalls. And he says, the principle on which this rule is founded seems to be that as courts of justice are open to the public, anything that takes place before a judge or judges is thereby necessarily and legitimately made public. So in our law and the media courses, dear colleague from the second row, that's the case which we use in Scotland, Richardson versus Wilson. It predates Scott and Scott by some 30 odd years. Now, the justice in a cold climate chair, obviously sort of, you know, you can argue, of course, that I've been talking about cases or statutes in a case from a relatively colder climate, Scotland. Let me move a little more north and east to Scandinavia. I've been interested in Scandinavia for quite a number of years now, having been responsible for publishing and promoting this Thoughts on Civil Liberty by Peter Forskjell, an unacknowledged and unknown jewel of Enlightenment literature. That's the book plug over, by the way, Judith Townend. 3ws.peterforskjell.com. A snip at 150 Swedish kroner. Really quite cheap. But the key thing is, of course, that made us very much focus on the first Freedom of Information Act. So let me just finally, Chair, focus on that for 2 seconds. First of all, it's often called the Freedom of the Press Act, 1766. Now, this is actually something of a translation misnomer, because it implies that there is a sort of press, or there was a press, in the same way as we've been talking about the press this morning. Clearly, in 18th century Sweden, that was absolutely not the case. There was nothing remotely like the sort of industrial mass media press that emerged in the middle of the 19th and late 19th century. So what is it actually referring to? The full and accurate translation, Chair, of the statute is His Majesty's Gracious Ordinance. Well, you just had to say that. That was a kind of sop to the king. His Majesty's Gracious Ordinance relating to freedom of writing and of the press, and what the Swedish word tryck means by way of press is, of course, the printing press. So it was freedom of printers and writers to publish material. And that's what this 1766 law was about. But the point I want to finally focus on, Chair, is that there are several articles in this 1766 statute which actually prescribe the legal publication of bits of legal material and judicial decisions. In other words, it's not just an Access to Information Act in the way that we now tend to usually think about that, i.e. as material held by public authorities, thinking of that as central and local government. My point is to remind us that a central aspect of this 1766 law was, for example, at Clause 6, that this freedom of the press, meaning the printing press, and to publish, shall include judgments and documents produced in proceedings before lower courts, appeal, and superior courts, which, when requested, shall be immediately issued to anyone who applies for them. There is another important clause at Clause 9, where it states that in addition to the records of trials, everyone who has a case or other proceedings touching his rights before the court may publish these, shall be free to publish or print an account of it together with those documents relating to it. And finally, Chair, the important clause 7, which talks about the right to publish the names of the judges and in relation to their votes in respect of particular cases. To avoid, the statute says, the hazardous consequence that may follow from imprudent judicial votes, their anonymity should no longer be protected, and because that, the statute says, interestingly, is no less injurious than unnecessary, and an impartial judge will be pleased if his impartiality becomes apparent. So the point that I'm making, Chair, in conclusion, is just to say that there are a number of specific legal enactments in other states, in other countries, including Scotland, including Sweden, one of which pertains very much to the notion of access to information, but in a way which we don't usually think of FOI laws as much these days. It focuses specifically on the publication of legal material and the right of the citizen to access it. Thank you.
Emily Alvin, who is head of the Law Library here at City University.
Is that my water? Sorry,
City Bank. Hi, everyone. Is that okay? I tried to get rid of my librarian voice for you. But if I start whispering, just tell me. So I've been tasked today with talking a little bit about the free legal information that's out there. I'm going to touch a little bit on the librarian sort of role in that, and a bit about the various movements there are to free up the law. So as, obviously, I'm speaking as a librarian, my main purpose is to meet the needs of my users and give them the best quality information I can that they need at that time. Law librarians work in all kinds of different institutions, whether academic like my own, law firms, chambers, inns, government. And the way in which legal information has changed over the last 10 to 15 years has made a real big impact on the way we provide our services. Believe it or not, I've always been quite free spirit, despite our rather austere sort of reputation. We've always been very sort of wanting to push forward the free resources there are out there, alongside our very expensive paid for commercial services. And in universities in particular, librarians have always been very, we're the ones pushing forward things like repositories, freeing up information to make it open to everyone. The other role we have, is particularly with relation to law, is around advocating and promoting resources and representing our users, so the lawyers, the students, whatever, against sometimes quite aggressive commercial publishers. Quality and authenticity are obviously really massive issues for us, and in the States, the AAA, which is the American Association of Law Librarians, has had quite a big impact on how the federal and state documentation are put out there, even changing completely the way that documents are provided online. And they cover all kinds of aspects around accessibility, reliability, comprehensiveness, and preservation as well. There's quite a big issue about what is official as well, so what can be used in court, and I'll touch on that a bit later on. Many of our the sort of official gazettes that contain legislation in European countries are freely available online. So in the early sort of 2000s, legal librarians played quite a big role in terms of getting free resources out there via gateways. First off was something called Sausage. That was the way it was pronounced. That then swapped over to the Intuit service, which funding stopped for last year. And that, all the resources in that database, which are all free resources, evaluated for quality, etc., have now been taken over by the Institute of Advanced Legal Studies on their Eagle Eye portal. Quite a few years ago now, when I came to City, I started up Lawball, which is our portal here. And my main driver for that was, in fact, I was concerned that a lot of our, particularly our undergraduates at that time, wouldn't necessarily be going to the big law firms, and they wouldn't have access to the kinds of materials that you get from Lexis or Westlaw. And so I did that so that those students who would maybe work in charities or not-for-profit organisations would still have access to stuff. There's a lot of international collaborations as well. So this is a American Society for International Law one, which again are all full of sites evaluated by librarians. So before we move on to the free stuff, we kind of have to touch on the expensive stuff as well, because that kind of drives how things work. We are very much in a situation where the big two, Lexis and Westlaw, still dominate very heavily. Although smaller publishers have emerged, and they are gaining strength actually over the last few years. In the past year or so, we've had quite a lot of problems within information provision, in that a lot of smaller publishers are removing their content from the big publishers. So now we're in a situation where we have to, we still have to subscribe to these big services, but also for these other ones as well, you know, which a couple of grand here, a couple of grand there, can make quite a big impact. So publishers like Jordan's, Informa, are the big culprits on that this year. So the costs around that are pretty prohibitive sometimes, not mentioning any names, Informa. They do really have us by the throat, basically, particularly as so many libraries, due to space, costs, etc., have, you know, often ditched their hard copy. So it's quite a hard balance to maintain. And obviously, you know, when it comes down to it, these services will drive their products by, you know, the people they make the most money out of, which are going to be the big law firms. So they don't really care about the rest of us. So the current UK situation, free-wise, is that there is a lot out there. As Hugh's already mentioned, we have come on in massive leaps and bounds from when I first started in the profession more years ago than I would like to admit. And obviously the hero of that is the Bailey service. And that's as close as we can get to being a one-stop shop. But we always want more, don't we? And there are obviously lots of frustrations with the way that material is provided by the government in various different formats that mean that we're not there yet. Obviously, there's the legislation.gov.uk site, which again Hugh has mentioned, and I might just say a bit more about that a bit later. The Parliament site obviously has loads of has Hansard and the various parliamentary committee information. So what can you actually get for free online? Obviously, judgments are the big one, with most of the courts with their own services, as well as passing them on to Bailey. Legislation, as we've said, there's a lot of issues around amendments, basically, which you can never quite be sure you're getting what you think you're getting. Treaties, from the UN website, again, that's quite tricky in that the very nature of it is that they're very disparate in where they appear, so not an easy thing to track down freely. And journals, not a huge amount of interest to those in the profession, but for the academic lawyers, is a big issue in the UK, particularly, publishers are obviously trying to make as much money as they can out of us. America is a lot better cover for free access, but here we're not so well off, unfortunately. Very few journals are truly open access. So where did this free legal web revolution begin? With universities initially. So in the early to mid 1990s, Cornell started publishing the US Supreme Court judgments and the New York Court of Appeals in 1992. And then that sort of baton was picked up by Canada the year after. And then Cornell was the very first what we call the Legal Information Institutes, and many of those have followed subsequently. And that's where the real driver for freeing up the law comes from. You can see the dates there for Ostley, which apparently has about I think I've got this fact right, 600,000 people looking at it per day, which is pretty massive. I hope I've got that right. And the Canly service, which developed out of the initial 93 product, is again massive. And I think, did I get some? Yeah, I found a few stats about it in that they did a big survey about through Canadian lawyers, and they said that 43% of Canadian lawyers surveyed said they could do more than half of their legal research via Canly rather than the commercial databases. And 71% of those said that it had reduced their legal information costs. So you can see the kind of impact that those services have. Bailey, I'm sure you all know about, I don't need to say very much about. Obviously, the thing that appeals to me as an academic librarian is that this sort of going back historically. So the Open Law Project made 2,500 judgments which are of historical purpose, openly available to everyone, which is fantastic, and the Privy Council ones as well. On a wider scale, we've got Worldly, which contains data from, as I've said, there are 17 legal information institutes, and it provides obviously one platform for searching all. Commonly, obviously covers the Commonwealth countries, and it also contains the English reports going the whole series, which is again a fantastic development. Basically, these LIIs are a really great starting point for searching for legal information produced by the governments, but they have a way to go to. The concept behind the LLI is obviously to bring free legal resources onto one searchable platform. They all have a very, very plain, simple way of searching, but a fairly complex search mechanism behind them. And they're all free, obviously. But because they're all developed separately, some of them, and many of them come from the work done by Austley, but you can see the kind of funding pattern is quite different between them. So you can see some have stemmed from universities and research centres, some from trusts, and some from the profession itself. So there's quite a lot of variety there. I managed to dig out a dissertation from early 2010 by one of our students on the MSc Information Science course here. And she did a sort of survey of chambers, of chambers librarians and barristers in those chambers around their use of free sources. And 64% of those said they used Bailey at least a few times a week, and sort of not far off for their sort of sister sites as well. Eurolex, which is the big portal to European law, and HUDOC, which is for human rights stuff, were also very highly used. Legislation, as you can probably expect, is infrequent. So there is a good deal of mistrust around that, around legislation in general, and most people would go to a paid-for site for that. The driver and the bill that draws the LIIs together is this free access to law movement. And I haven't really got the time to go into that, so I've put a link at the end for people to read up on. But that's obviously quite an interesting. They've got a lot of principles around where they think we should be going. Free Legal Web from Nick Holmes, who I think is I saw, is obviously a way to look at bringing law together and people collaborating. And last slide, I think. Obviously, keeping up to date on what is out there, there's a lot more option for that now. So with Twitter, following people's personal blogs, the Inner Temple service is pretty good, and the Bailey RSS feeds are also very good. We do have to just think about whether one other issue that's been raised quite a lot is it enough to have the law out there, you know, the black letter law? Is it enough if we're ultimately providing for the man on the street? Is it enough to provide it as it is? Should we be providing some context as well? And in other jurisdictions like France, they do cover that also. This is probably going to overlap lots of other people, but obviously making legal information accessible is making justice more accessible. And allowing access to this information means those fighting for justice can do it on a lower cost. There's the whole thing around ignorance of the law being no excuse, but if no one can see it, how can they, you know, what can they truly do about it? And the transparency thing has already been mentioned. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Emily. We're running about approximately 10 minutes late, so we'll just an opportunity for people if they want to make any comments or questions. Yes. Do you also to remind you to identify?
I think that's the Court of Appeal are just considering a case dealing with this very point, where judgment was reserved 2 weeks ago when the Guardian made an application. I mean, the position is that in civil cases, anything that's mentioned in open court subject to certain qualifications becomes a public document. And there are practical issues about getting it, but there's a theoretical right to it. The criminal rules have never contained such a provision, and the Guardian complained about precisely the issue you mentioned. They've said that effectively there's a arising out of Article 10, there's a right to access to information. The judgment is, you know, any time. But I suspect the Court of Appeal, they lost the first time round, and I think they may lose this time round, which is a big problem.
Can I just add that? I'm a BBC journalist and I have the same position as you. I have in the past made applications to judges using a document supplied by the BBC's legal department for disclosure of stuff. And sometimes I've got it and sometimes I haven't. But to endorse your point, the one which I really wanted was very expensive because it was a transcript of something which happened before and I couldn't get hold of it because we couldn't pay the costs of quite a couple of things.
Can you say your name?
Sorry, my name is Richard.
Into these, I put them on the web, I could link it, people could link into them, and it would help me with the discussion. People could make contributions, help me to prepare my case. Because people can't discuss the case, which would be valuable for me, and they could go along to the case and they know all about it. Same thing as the journalists. I'm not allowed to give people any big court documents, which they would be able to in the United States, apparently. Is that true?
In the United States, they have the court file. They have a concept of a court file, and everything that's in civil cases that is put on the court file is available. The press haven't really pressed their claims. I mean, it is infuriating. Not being, you are entitled to certain arguments, your judgment is wrong.
I can publish my skeleton argument.
Yes, of course you can. The difficulty of getting access in criminal cases to the file of evidence and pictures and so forth is always the prosecution is entitled to give it to the police. But this is, in a sense, the power that the police hold over.
Sorry, she was talking about free rather than free to use, and you're also talking about those making it accessible to ordinary people. And the requirement to be able to do that is to be able to take it from its current silo, if you like, whether that's Bailey or whatever, in a form that can be used by other people, whether it's on an app or combined with other information or analysed and made sense of. And even when you were talking about the official journals and so on, the licensing of those is not clear on a European level. Usually they are free to view on the web, but they're not explicitly openly licensed. And I think until we in the 21st century, where essentially our lives are data, we really ought to be using the word free or freely reusable, without restriction, rather than just essentially like a museum exhibit you can look at but you can't touch.
Can I just make a comment about that? Because I mean, it's interesting about skeleton arguments. Of course, you can use your own because it's your own document. You do whatever you like. But the other sides, you can have access to it. But strictly speaking, it's their copyright. So I mean, you can't publish it because you would be, and that's the issue you mentioned. I mean, there's one getting hold of things, and then there's the other publishing them yourself. And as the last speaker said, I mean, there's a massive issue about the seconds of those in relation to all these things.
So I'm allowed to publish anything online?
Yes, absolutely. Subject to the
libel contempt.
Well, we didn't know this was going to involve free advice here as well today.
So I do a lot of work for the Innocence Project and getting access. Getting access to court transcripts could literally mean the difference between cracking a case or not for us. They're hugely expensive, too expensive even for the BBC, as we've heard, and we don't have any financial funding. Mr. Tomlinson mentioned that there are contracts in place that mean that only certain companies can do transcripts, and that's one thing, but going back to digital in the future, there are recordings of these things. What would happen if you asked for the recording, just a copy of the recording, for you to use, possibly make your own transcript, things like that?
Well, Heather Brook is a great expert on this, having pursued the evil authorities on this for a number of years. But I mean, the position is that, as I understand it, you cannot get those transcripts to make recordings yourself. I mean, they're fascinating, just sort of by the way. One of the great stories about access to justice in the US is about fights to get the transcripts of the Supreme Court hearings. And ultimately, a campaigner got them, and they're all now published. I mean, you can hear all the great historic US Supreme Court cases are all available to listen to. The US Supreme Court now actually publish a digital, you can have a transcript and a recording, the hearing the next day. But in England, you can't get round the kind of commercial arrangements which people make money out of selling transcripts. You can't get round by, you can't record it yourself in court, and you can't get round it by getting the recordings either.
They said
come from, they come from the courts. And that's how we overcome that problem with the transcribers. Having said that, as most of you realize, with criminal law embedded, you don't have that facility. Nobody in the criminal courts is fulfilling the function that they are in the other courts. By sending this, we get a few transcribed and a lot of handouts, well, not a lot, a few handouts, but we don't get a steady flow of transcribers.
Just a brief point. The point about transcripts and recordings. I guess yeah, right. Mike Dodd from Media Lawyer and Press Association. The point about transcripts and recordings is that all transcripts must be approved by the judge before they're sent out. So you won't get the recording because the judge might rewrite things. He might decide that he shouldn't have said no, probably not, but he might have put something in there he doesn't want people to read. Judges occasionally make mistakes as well, so they'll take them down, which is why you won't get hold of the original transcript. You might get permission from the judge to make a recording of a hearing, but only if it's for personal purposes or for note-taking purposes. For example, you're suffering from a disability, you can't take shorthand and you can't write. And again, it's on the basis that that recording will not be used for broadcasting purposes or for any other kind of publication purpose.
Okay, thank you for that. I think we ought to end our session now. So I'd like to thank our chief David.